Today is May 13th, and I'm going to interview English Showalter. We are in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I'm at his home. And first, I'm going to ask him about his childhood. So can you tell me about your childhood?
Anything more specific than my childhood?
What it was like growing up?
Well, I was born in Roanoke in 1935. May 14th, actually, so almost my birthday today. God. Is it going again?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Sorry, the phone rang.
My family lived in South Roanoke. I was the first child in my family. And for the first 2 years, approximately, of my life, which I have no memory of at all, we lived in an apartment on Avonham Avenue, about a block away from where my father's father lived, and in between one of my father's brothers and his family lived. And then we moved when I was 2 years old, I think because my mother was expecting my brother, to a house still only about four blocks away on what was then called Lafayette Avenue, but is now Longview Avenue, also in South Roanoke. And lived there. I lived there really all the time I spent in Roanoke. My parents moved around 1960 to another house about a half a block away, higher up the hill on Longview Avenue. When I first lived there, it was 525 Lafayette Avenue, and by the time I left, it was 2619 Longview Avenue. But it was the same house in the same place. I went to a private kindergarten when I was four, called Mrs. Genheimer's, and it was over on the other side of South Roanoke. And I have very few real memories about that. Most of what I remember from these years are when I did something and got scolded for it. So I remember a day when we were supposed to be talking about things in class and I couldn't get my two bits in, and so I screamed and said, "I want to talk," and I got punished for that. And another time, I and a bunch of my friends were playing with the blocks there, and we built an airplane. And the teacher came over and said, "What is this?" And we said, "It's an airplane." And she said, "What are you going to do with it?" And we said we were going to drop some bombs on Germany. This would have been in 1939 or 1940, so early news of the war. And she said, no. These are going to be food bombs. You're just going to drop food for people. You don't want to blow things up." And I was extremely annoyed about that. By this time, I had a little brother. He was born when I was 2.5 years old. And my best friend in those years was a little girl who lived next door. Her name was Marianne Pickett. She was a year older than I was. But we played together all the time, and I guess the Depression or something had stopped temporarily the development of the residential area in South Roanoke. And so behind our house was a big patch of woods that had no houses on it or anything. It does now. But I think it had just been abandoned because people couldn't afford new houses and things. So that was our playground, and we climbed trees and made paths and chased little animals and caught snakes and box turtles and caught poison ivy, did all sorts of things like that. I went to Miss Genheimer's school for 2 years and then went to public school at Crystal Spring. I went in at 6 years old, but I went into the second grade. And I went there and through the seventh grade. So a very large part of my childhood in Roanoke was spent in Crystal Spring School. I have a lot of memories of that. Nothing very important, it seems to me. Kind of every other year, I liked my teacher, and in the alternate years, I hated my teacher. And after that, for the 8th and 9th grade, I went to Lee Junior High School, which I think no longer exists. It was downtown on Franklin Road, right near the Appalachian Power Building, and corner of 2nd Street, I think. And it was a big change from Crystal Spring, where everybody lived within not quite everybody. There were some students who were bused in, but almost everybody lived within walking distance of it. Whereas at Lee Junior, they came from all over the city, and I had to take a bus to and from school or a streetcar, which were still running at the time. And the circle of people that I came in contact with was considerably different from what it had been in Crystal Spring, and the most vivid example of that is that in 1 year in my homeroom class, I was sitting in an assigned desk near the back of the room, and the student who had the desk next to mine was named Sammy, and he had a Eastern European last name. Forgotten exactly what it was. But he looked a whole lot older than he really was, and he really was at least 1 year older than anybody else in the class, and therefore 2 years older than me. And he had actually run away and enlisted in the Marines when he was 15 years old, lying about his age, and then they had found out he was younger than he was supposed to be. So they threw him out of the Marines, and he had to go back to school. Every day, he brought 2 beers for lunch. But he was afraid that the teacher would look in his desk, so he gave them to me, and I kept them in my desk. Because she never looked in my desk. And it was also as you could guess from that, there were some fairly tough kids in the school. And one of the ways that I avoided being bullied or picked on, because I was much smaller than most of the other kids, boys or girls, was that in the first class in the day, which was a history class, as I recall, or maybe social studies, we would have homework assignments, and there were about 3 people in the class who actually did the assignment, me being one of them. And when we would get to class, the first thing we would do would be to give it to the person next to us, who would copy it, and then they would hand the 2 copies to 2 other people. And within a fairly short time, everybody in the class had a copy of the homework to turn in. And as long as I didn't resist doing that. Everybody was happy to leave me alone. We had physical education classes where we had to walk from there over to Elmwood Park, where the library was, still is, I guess, but in those days it was just an old house. The original Elmwood was a house that belonged to one of the old Roanoke families, Taylors maybe, and in the park around it we were instructed to play games of various kinds, one of which was touch football, but there were a number of kids in the class who played very rough, and so I didn't enjoy that. And after a while, I and a friend of mine got in the habit of sneaking out of the class and going into the library, and we would spend phys ed class in the library reading. I was very interested in tropical fish at the time, and there was a beautiful book with illustrated pictures of tropical fish, so I would look at these pictures, daydream about owning those fish. And at the end of ninth grade, I was sent away to prep school, and I never lived in Roanoke for lengthy periods after that. I came back in the summers for vacations and shorter vacations at Christmas and spring break and things like that, and I did spend one other year at home because I had been sick and had to drop out of college for a year. But that's really the end of my time in Roanoke. So I was 14, 1949 was the last year that I was really a resident of Roanoke.
So how does where you live now differ from where you grew up? Or your memories of
it? Well, it differs in so many ways that it is almost impossible to describe. I think about it every now and then as, suppose this were the year I was born, 1935, and I were somebody the age I am now, when would I have been born? And the answer is 1853. And if you think about the changes that took place between 1853 and 1935, it is just about inconceivable. And everything electric did not exist in 1853. Of course, slavery still did exist. There were lots and lots of other major inventions like the internal combustion engine and the steel and steel frame construction that enabled buildings to be built higher than 5 or 6 stories. So that the whole landscape of the country really changed rapidly. Most of the big municipal systems like sewers and running water and obviously electrification, all that came in that period. And so in some ways I think probably the change is as inconceivable to someone born now from what it was like when I was born. Although, to me, having lived through it, it never seemed very dramatic. I mean, there was never a moment when I sort of said, oh, everything is different now. I mean, some things that happened, which I remember a great deal about, like the Second World War, were really earth-shattering events, especially if you were in Europe where the war was going on, or in the parts of Asia and the Pacific where it was going on. And there were very noticeable things that happened In Roanoke, there was rationing, so that lots of things that people take for granted became scarce. You had to have ration coupons for gasoline. You had to have ration coupons for tires. So automobile travel was greatly reduced, except for people who were deemed necessary for the war effort. Various kinds of food were considered to be scarce, and there was a shortage of things like sugar and tropical fruits, oranges, this kind of thing. And candy and bubble gum, I don't know whether there was any real reason for them to be scarce or not, but as kids, they were very rare. And one of my friends at Crystal Spring at some point got as a present, a little box that had 25 pieces of bubble gum in it, and he was selling them to classmates for, they cost a penny each, I think, at the time, and he was selling them, I think, for a quarter. In any case, the principal of the school found out about this and called him into her office and bawled him out and said he was running a black market and this was profiteering and so forth. And he was about 8 or 9 years old. And it sort of, at the end, when rationing ended, things began to come back. I got caught because it was Lent, when people, I don't know what church you were brought up in, but the Episcopal Church, we were told we had to give up something for Lent, for the 40 days of Lent, and so I had been giving up candy, and it didn't make any difference, there wasn't any candy anyway. This year I gave up candy, and all of a sudden there were Hershey bars everywhere and so forth. So I was very distressed, and my mother finally agreed with my conscience that I would buy it, but I wouldn't eat it until the end of Lent. So I had this big stash of candy bars, and when Lent ended, I ate it all and got sick, and I've really never liked it much since. So it was a good thing in the long run. I like that. We also did things like have air raid drills, and my father was a warden, and I don't know how often, but often enough so that I remember it happening repeatedly. He would go out and in the evening, and we had heavy oilcloth curtains that we would pull down that completely blocked out any light, and we couldn't even have any lights on. We had blue light bulbs that we could use. And he would go out, and other wardens, and each one of them had a couple of blocks that they patrolled and checked to make sure all the lights were out and everybody was paying attention. Then they would sound a siren, and this was all in the event of an attack by air, which of course I think was never remotely a possibility, but what are some of the other... Oh, we had a victory garden. That was the other thing, which I learned sometime after the war was totally unnecessary, but was intended to give people a sense of participating. So there was also a big area at the lower part of Longview Avenue that was undeveloped. It's got apartment buildings on it now, but it was just fields then. And so it had been taken over, and we had what the British would call an allotment, which is a little patch of ground that doesn't belong to you, but you have the right to grow flowers or vegetables in it. So we had one of these, and every day, or every couple of days at least, we would go down with our tools and seeds and plant, and we grew, I don't know, radishes and lettuce and carrots and things like that. Considered that part of our contribution to winning the war. We also, I was we had a thing called junior commandos, which meant that every Saturday I would go out with a little wagon and go around the neighborhood and pick up spare grease, which was presumably used for making munitions in some way. And so I knew all of the, most of the families in that neighborhood had maids, but few didn't, but I knew all of the families or maids that I went by and picked up a bucket of grease from, and we had a big container, and we'd take it to school on Monday, and it was presumably poured into a bigger one still. I don't know what the grease was coming from, because they didn't have bacon. That was another wartime scarcity. After the war, everybody had tons of bacon grease, but in those days, I'm not sure what it was.
So in the Virginia Room, I've seen a few maps with your family's name on it, Showalter, on big estates. And I was wondering if your family still owns any property in Roanoke.
I think the answer to that is really no. The Showalters never did own huge amounts of land in Roanoke. My mother's family, who were named Watts, did own a really, really large plantation that covered most of what is now the northern part of Roanoke City and a big chunk around on the eastern side that includes, I think it included everything north of the Roanoke River in the eastern part of Roanoke. But that was when there wasn't any Roanoke, it was Big Lick. And as Big Lick grew into something more like a city, and the family divided up, the owner, who was a single person at one point, divided it up among four children, and then the one who owned the largest part passed it on to two direct descendants who didn't have brothers and sisters who split it up. But they still own, that family still owns a big piece of it. My father liked to buy business properties, but they were never in the, never residential things. He owned some little buildings in Salem that were rented to stores, and some pieces of undeveloped property on Route 460 between Roanoke and Salem and things like that. And in the very old days, if you're looking at those maps, I've forgotten what the man's name is who made the maps that showed the original land holding.
Sanborn? The Sanborn maps?
That's not the name I'm thinking of. Is it the man? He had a multi-syllable name, I think. In any case, he had plotted onto a modern map the land holdings in, 1850 or something like that. And there was a Showalter who owned not a very large, but a piece of land at that time. But I don't know what kin he was to me. It was not my direct ancestor. Okay. Very likely an uncle or, a cousin of an uncle or something.
So when you were in Roanoke, were there any existing black or white communities at the time?
Yes. There was a large black population who lived mainly in the area that was just north of the railroad tracks and running on to the west out toward, toward the southern edge of where the Watts plantation had been. There's a stream that runs along there that was kind of the dividing line. And then it ran on out to the city limit. And most of that area was predominantly, if not entirely, black. There were very, very large numbers of them who worked in other parts of the city, including South Roanoke. I mean, all of, as I said before, most of the people that we picked up grease from on Saturdays had maids, and those maids were, I think, 100% black. They all took the streetcar from South Roanoke out to their area of town. And they all knew each other from riding on the streetcar and things together and social life that they had in their churches and things like that. But they also knew each other in the neighborhood because we spent a lot of time outdoors and just sort of got to know each other back and forth, so I knew everybody else's maid as well as our own. And then besides the maids, who really, I mean, they, in the tradition of the sort of the southern mammy type thing, I mean, they really brought up the children. They were nannies as well as cooks and cleaners. There were also a lot of men who did things like yard maintenance and gardening. In the early days, we had a coal-burning furnace, and there was a man who would come every morning before dawn and put coal into the furnace so that it would heat up by the time the family got up. And I think he had a string of houses that he did that for. All I know about him is that his name was Mose. I'm not sure I ever saw him, but I remember well my family talking about him. And then that gradually changed. I mean, one of the things that I have seen change was, in my earliest years, it was a coal town. The railroad brought the coal through and they transshipped it in the Roanoke yards and things like that. Everybody had a coal furnace, and the first big step towards progress was everybody got a stoker that only had to be filled once every 3 or 4 days, and that put people like Mose out of business, because when you had a stoker, you didn't need to have somebody come every day. You filled it yourself, and it gradually fed the stuff in. And in those sort of intermediate years, when I guess I was in Crystal Spring, one of my jobs was to go down every 2 or 3 days and fill up my grandmother's stoker. And then, eventually, everybody shifted to oil furnaces. I think I was gone from Roanoke by the time that happened, and so forth. And I grew up very much aware of the railroads, because our house, it was high enough up on the hill so that you could see across the valley, and you could see Round Hill, which was on the Watts Plantation. But it was within hearing distance of the Virginian Railway yards. I mean, the Norfolk and Western bought the Virginian Railway, but the big railroad yard that's close to the river between Jefferson Street and Franklin Road, that was the Virginian Railroad all the time I was in Roanoke. And it was a big yard where they unhitched the locomotives that brought it down from West Virginia, and hitched it on to a different one that took it on down to Norfolk and vice versa when it was going back. And we could hear the sounds, the chuffa, chuffa, chuffa sounds of the steam engines, which I still find very relaxing and soothing. Don't hear it much anymore, but quite like it. And any railroad sounds. I mean, I like, been a while since I was in Roanoke, but I like to stay in the hotel Roanoke because it was close to the railroad and you could hear the trains going by, and I like that.
Was there any neighborhood segregation or segregation at all during the time that you lived in Roanoke?
Oh, it was total. Yeah, it was the law.
Can you describe some of that?
Well, you know, I was hardly aware of it until I got to be a teenager, and around that time I wasn't living in Roanoke anymore. I mean, for the most part, people accepted it. And just didn't pay much attention to it. There were things that black people were forbidden to do, and there were things that white people were not supposed to do because it would interfere with the smooth operating of the system. As kids, I and my friends used to violate all the time the rule that was posted in all public transport, whites to front, colored to rear. Whether you've ever seen one of those signs or not, but all of the streetcars and buses had a notice like that posted on it somewhere. And we wanted to go sit in the back, so we did. Although, if it got to be fairly crowded, we would occasionally be asked by one of the black riders to move up to our own part. The most obvious incident that I ever had any contact with, I don't know what year this would have been. It must have been in the 1950s, and probably the year I was home because of being sick, which would have been 1953-54. One of the black churches got together with St. John's Episcopal Church, which was my family's church, and they worked together on producing some kind of a musical production. I've forgotten whether it was a choir recital or a performance of a musical or something like that. And I think all of the performers in it were from the black community. And the white church provided financial support and helped pay for the sets and the costumes and lighting and this kind of thing. Anyway, it was most of the people that I knew disapproved of segregation, wished it did not exist, were happy to see it go when it did go. And this was a way of, they thought, of sort of avoiding it and doing something that showed interracial cooperation and so forth. But it was against the law to have the audience unsegregated. And the plan had been that nobody was going to say anything about it, and they were just going to go in and sit together. And somebody reported it. And so they were forced. And it was a terrible crisis. I mean, everybody was dismayed because it sort of undid the whole spirit of the thing. And I think what they finally did was agree to have an imaginary line down the middle so that, in fact, there were going to be, in every row, there would be whites and blacks sitting next to each other, but they would all be the same to either side. And, you know, my family was just distraught about it, that this person had intervened and wrecked this plan. But other than that, I had been gone for several years before the Supreme Court decision desegregating the schools came into effect. So, the school I went to was in this area. It's Episcopal High School across Alexandria. It was as segregated a school as you can imagine. And, you know, it's the Episcopal school, so it basically had white Southerners in it. Boys, all boys.
Can you describe the difference between the segregation here and in Alexandria?
Like what was that? Now?
No, when you went to the high school, from what you had experienced when you grew up in Roanoke.
Well, when I was in the high school, I don't think we ever saw a black person. There were certainly none in the student body, and there were none in the faculty. There may have been some who were working in things like groundskeeping or something, but I don't remember them if they were there. Certainly had no significant contact with them. And, of course, the state of Virginia, where it is, was under the law of segregation then. So any of the places that I would have gone would have been segregated as well. In the city of Washington, there was, I don't know what the legal situation was, but the segregation was just about the same as it was in Virginia. There was a black area of town, which I never set foot in, and then there was the downtown area, and I mean, I didn't go. We couldn't go in very much. We, in order to keep us from mingling with the townies, not because they were black, just because they were townies, we had our day off on Monday. So Mondays we could, if we had behaved ourselves, we could come into Washington. We'd take the bus in and what I normally did, I and my friends would take the bus in, and we would go to movies. There was a movie theater in the area of DuPont Circle that showed double features of the Marx Brothers. And we would do that, and we would eat at the White Tower, which was a little hamburger joint, and have five hamburgers and see two Marx Brothers movies, and that would be our day in Washington. And sometimes we did something else, nothing ever very educational. I mean, it wasn't like we came in and went to the Museum of Natural History or anything. But the big theaters at that time, movie theaters, had live stage shows. And so sometimes you could go to the movie, and, you know, they had these big Wurlitzer organs and things like that. Every now and then there was a show that we wanted to see at one of those, and I remember vividly going to hear a singer named Frankie Lane. You ever hear Frankie Lane?
Maybe.
Probably well before you were born, but in the late 1940s, early 1950s, he had two big hits kind of right in a row. One was called Lucky Old Sun. Up in the morning, out on the job, work like a devil for my pay. So play it on YouTube. Look it up. You can hear it. And the other one was called Mule Train. And he came and did a show in the movie in Washington. So we went to see that. But those movie theaters were all segregated. And walking on the streets, there would have been some black people walking on the streets, but way below the proportion of the black population of the city.
So we're going to move a little away from that topic, and we're going to move more towards this question. What does the word Oaklands mean to you?
Well, Oaklands was the name of the plantation that my three-great-grandfather built in the northern part of what is now Roanoke. The time he built it, which was around 1818, Roanoke County was still part of Pottawatomie County, and the only settlement immediately close to it was Big Lick, which was barely more than a crossroads with a couple of shacks by it. Salem was the main town in the area, and it was an important stop on the road from the east through the Cumberland Gap out into the Midwest. So there was heavy, heavy traffic of settlers who, a lot of them came down the Shenandoah Valley, and others came just from the east and across the where Route 460 is now, sort of from Lynchburg. And then they went on west through Salem and Christiansburg and on out where the interstate goes now. My personal memories of Oaklands are that I had a relative who lived there. We called Aunt Dolly. I made you a list of the people who lived at Oakland so you could follow this. And if you come down to...
Right now we're looking at the list.
Yeah, if you look down at number 321, William Watts, and he married Ellen Cotone, and she was Aunt Dolly.
Okay.
The Cotones, it's an Italian name, and I guess they were Italian orange, and he was a grocer, and they bought a piece of land that had been part of Oakland's out near Round Hill. And so I guess that's how they happened to know each other. And they ran off and got married because I think her father didn't approve or something in any case. They were happily married, and although he died fairly young, he was only 50, and she lived on another 40 years. So all the time I knew her, she was a widow, and they had one son, who was William Watts, my mother's first cousin. And he was my mother's age, so I didn't know him really well, but had some contact with him. But we used to go out a lot to see Aunt Dolly, and it was a place where I could play, and it was a farm then between, the house that Michael lives in, that was Aunt Dolly's house, and from there over to Round Hill was all cornfields. And there was a little cemetery there that was moved to Fairview back in the 1970s when they developed it. And all the shopping malls on the other side of the interstate are built on what was farmland in those days. And a good deal of the development around 10th Street and out towards the airport, most of the houses there were built after the war. And at one point, almost all of that land had been part of Oakland's. But when I was alive and knew about it, it had been sharply reduced, but was still quite a large farm. And it was a working farm. They had dairy cows in the barn behind that was down close to the creek. And vegetable gardens that was down in the yard on the east side of the house, and toward the rear, there was a huge vegetable and flower garden that Dolly, she had a black live-in maid whose name was, we called her Raya, but her real name was Mariah, and they lived there together for, I don't know, 30 years or something, just the two of them.
So, on your aunt's old house, where we live now, there's old, I want to say they're platforms, I don't know how to describe it, old foundations. Have you seen those when you went down there?
I may have done, but I don't remember it.
Okay.
Now, the house that you're in was built around 1970. There was a house there before that burned down in 1897, I think it was, because the number 32 on here, John Allen Watts, decided he was the owner of it and decided to develop it in the 1890s, which was a boom period for Roanoke. You know, it grew, it sort of tripled in size every 10 years for a couple of decades. He turned it over to a land development company, and they sold off pieces of it, and some of the houses along 10th Street, or what I knew as 10th Street Extension, were some of the original chunks taken out of Oakland's and sold to other people. And some of those people, one of them, the Hunt family, married into one of the families that's related to me. And there's another one whose name I've forgotten that owned a big house that's still there, right at the end of Rockland, across 10th Street. There's a big old house up there. And it was built in this period. And the Cotonis were among the people who moved into the area at this period. If you look at that book I gave you, it talks about this and get some idea. They laid out some streets and so forth, but then the boom kind of came to an end, and it reverted to the Watts family. So that Oakland Development Company went bankrupt, but the land came back into the Watts family, and that's why my Aunt Dolly was living there. And then her son, another William Watts, moved into the other little thing there. It used to be a barn when I was little, or a shed. I mean, they kept farm vehicles in there and hung onions to dry and things like that.
So it was a plantation. Was it ever a slaveholding plantation?
Oh, yes. One of the largest slave-owning plantations, maybe the largest in Roanoke County. And the up here at the top, the Elizabeth Breckenridge, the Breckenridge family lived in Botetourt County, kind of just the other side of Tinker Mountain. And they owned another very large plantation up there, which was, I think, the largest, or one of the two or three largest in Botetourt County. So, yes, they definitely were slave owners.
Do you have any idea what the numbers were?
I could look it up and tell you, I think. But I don't know right offhand. I would say somewhere around 100, but I'm not certain about that.
So I know you've done research on some of this stuff. What was something that was appealing to you when you began your research, or even as you went through it?
Well, appealing about them or appealing to me about doing the research, because they're two different things. I mean, I love looking at old papers and deciphering old handwritings and things like that, so...
Appealing in the sense of the information you were gathering.
Yeah. Well, I liked very much discovering the background of a lot of things that I had seen and known and heard about when I was young and grew up surrounded by, and people I had known that I had no idea how they were connected to me, and found out about it through doing this. A lot of people that my parents had talked about, sort of names that I had heard, and then, but you know, until I was quite old, I really never paid much attention to kinship systems, and so people would talk about, you know, my mother used to go see somebody whose name was wasn't a real name, but everybody called her Beauty, and her last name was Persinger. But I had no idea who they were. There's a street in Roanoke named Persinger, and they lived in that street, and they owned a fairly big piece of land there, is why it's called Persinger. And they are, in some distant way, kin to me, and I was really pleased to find that out. I love maps, and I really enjoyed reading the documents about how Edward Watts put together the plantation and bought other pieces of land, and in some cases traded one piece for another piece, and sort of assembled this enormously large estate that was the plantation. And it was really interesting to me. I had known absolutely nothing about it, what they grew on the plantation and what the crops were. And I think in the early days it was possible to grow things and make a living there, that later just economically wasn't feasible. Things like wheat. I mean, one of the big products was flour. They grew the wheat and they milled the flour, and then they shipped the flour to Richmond, where there was a big market. But the quantities that you can grow in the Roanoke area are just too small to make it a viable product in this day and age. But it must have lasted a fairly long time, because there was, until fairly recently, the Roanoke City Mill. Do you know? It's on Jefferson Street near, do you know where Victory Stadium was? I think there's probably still a stadium there.
No.
Well, you know where Jefferson Street is?
I'm really bad at directions. Apparently, yes, I know.
Well, Jefferson Street is the main north-south street in Roanoke. And it runs from the middle of downtown, kind of straight out.
Beside the Virginia Room?
Beside the Virginia Room.
Yeah, I know, yeah, I know.
You know that. Well, if you keep going out that, you come to a bridge that goes over the Virginian railroad tracks, big round arched bridge. And just on the other side of that, on the left side of Jefferson Avenue, as you go south towards South Roanoke, there was a flour mill that was called the Roanoke City Mills. And it had, I think, four big concrete sort of silo-like towers that they stored the grain and the flour and stuff in. And they produced, I think it was called Metropolitan and Light White Flours were the two brands they sold. In any case, it was a functioning business through most of my childhood. And at some point they had a fire there, and they had to spray water all over the flour in those things, and it rotted in there and produced the worst stench that you could ever imagine. And it must have gone out of business quite some time ago, but I don't know whether it was ever demolished or not, what they did with it. You should go look at it if you're interested in this kind
of thing. I'll go drive down the street and I'll let you know.
So anyway, that means I was very much interested, you know, I'm interested in knowing the background of the past. And, you know, I have a lot of admiration for the life that these people lived. Sort of they were pioneers when they came to the area. There was kind of nothing there, and they hacked it out of the woods. I don't think there were any Native Americans left by that time in this area, at least not in numbers sufficient to be any sort of threat. But one of the children here, the second, Mary Scott Watts, the Gamble family, who had been living in Richmond, moved to Florida, and she went down to stay with them and fell in love with her first cousin and married him. And that was still Indian country. There were Indian raids on the settlers and things down there, and she wrote back about it. I think Andrew Jackson put an end to that. But the hardships of life, I mean, look at the 10 children and the number of them that died very young, is quite striking for, you know, very different from a modern age. Their chances of survival were limited, and then the son, William Watts, who carried on the line, his wife, Mary Jane Allen, died when she was 30. And it is also very interesting to read about their engagements in the politics and things of their time. Edward Watts was a general. It's the title he got in the War of 1812, because he was in the Virginia militia and was a high-ranking figure in the Virginia militia. And up until after the Civil War, the United States didn't have a standing army. It had this different states had militias. That's why there's a Second Amendment. So that people could arm themselves to join the state militias. They never had any clue that it was going to be applied to some of the things it's applied to now. But then William Watts, his son, was a colonel in the Civil War, which meant that he raised a regiment in the area and went off and led it, and they fought in Northern Virginia and in the Peninsula campaigns. I don't think William Watts, I don't think 321, I'm not sure, I don't think he fought in World War I. But his son was in World War II and was stationed on the Aleutian Islands in Alaska for part of it. But they talk, I mean, in the materials that I've looked at, they do talk about issues of the day. There's a lot of anguish about the events leading up to the Civil War, and they were all in the party that did not want to secede, wanted to find a compromise, but they all still felt much more loyalty to the state than they did to the federal government. And so when the state seceded, they went along with that.
So I've interviewed a few people asking them what the word opens mean to them, and they don't know what it is. Back when you were growing up, did anyone know what Oaklands was? Was that still an alive idea, or was it kind of people just didn't know unless someone told them?
I think outside of the family and maybe a few close friends, nobody knew.
So it's not surprising that people don't know?
No, I don't think, no. Unless they were history buffs, they wouldn't know.
Okay.
Because... well, beginning in 1890, even really beginning before that, it was being broken up. But I think in 1890 is roughly when John Allen Watts, number 32 there, he was a lawyer, and he's the one that set up the development company. He moved into downtown, well, it's not downtown quite, it's the... the place they lived is totally gone now. It's also right off Jefferson Street in an area known as Orchard Hill. But I think the hill has been totally leveled now, and it's the community hospital has taken over the whole thing. When it started, community hospital was down at one end of it, but there used to be a residential community behind it, and I think that's all gone. And that's where he lived.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close the interview?
Don't think so. I mean, there's almost nothing you could ask me about Roanoke that I wouldn't probably be able to babble on for a while about. I was going to ask you, have you read a book called True Vine?
No.
You should do that. It's about Roanoke. You might even be able to get in touch with the woman who wrote it, who I think maybe she must live somewhere close to Roanoke. Name is Macy, can't remember her first name. The basic story of it is about two albino black brothers who, Truvine is the name of a little town somewhere east of Roanoke. And they were, according to the family story, they were kidnapped by a circus recruiter and displayed as freaks. This started back around 1900, I think. Earlier than that, maybe. Any case, their mother eventually went and found them and brought them home. And it's a complicated story. I mean, I'm not going to tell you much more about it than that. But they, in their later years, they lived in Roanoke. They lived just off 10th Street on the southern side of the railroad tracks, in a little black area out there. But it's a fascinating story, and it talks a lot about the situation of blacks in Roanoke at the time. She says that Roanoke was one of the worst cities in the whole South for segregation and mistreatment of blacks, which I think is an exaggeration. And maybe worse than just an exaggeration, maybe just wrong. But there was, in the 1890s, a really terrible lynching in Roanoke that, if you're interested in the history of Roanoke, you ought to look up and read about. Somebody wrote a book about it, sort of trying to figure out why this happened and so forth. And that J. Allen Watts, number 32, tried to be like Atticus Finch and To Kill a Mockingbird, and he went out and tried to tell the crowd to go home and so forth. Didn't work. But he made the effort anyway. In any case, it is an interesting read, and if you're doing a thing about the history of Roanoke, you really ought to look at that. But other than that, I won't say any more.
Alrighty, well, thank you so much for interviewing with me.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Hope you get a good... Is this your thesis or something, or your project?
Just a project.
Hope you get a... top marks for your project.
Well, thank you.